Hello and welcome to the programme. I'm Daniela Lazarová and we begin with the news. The three parties in the Czech governing coalition are to meet for another round of talks on the setup of a new cabinet, which would break the political stalemate in the Czech Republic. The governing parties are looking to end months of political instability sparked by a scandal over Prime Minister Stanislav Gross's private finances by negotiating the setup of a new semi-caretaker government under a different prime minister. They have so far failed to agree on two important issues, the division of ministerial posts and whether the new government should be formed on the basis of a full coalition agreement or a one-off deal as proposed by the Social Democrats. The Christian Democratic Party has refused to consider a one-off deal for fear that it would not provide enough guarantees against possible future cooperation between the Social Democrats and the Communists. Meanwhile, President Klaus on Tuesday urged the coalition parties to speed up the process of resolving the ongoing political crisis. He said a solution should be found within hours, not days or weeks, and urged all parties involved to focus on the main goal and be prepared to make concessions. The president said that if the coalition parties failed to reach agreement soon, he would be forced to take what he called radical action. The Association of Industry and Trade does not agree with a so-called national allocation plan for trading in CO2 emissions worth 97.6 million tons a year, which was approved by the European Commission on Tuesday. The Czech Republic failed to defend its plan of 107.6 million tons a year, which was approved by the Czech cabinet last year. The association says the plan limits space for new investment in energy-demanding branches. According to the Industry and Trade Ministry, the negotiated figure is an acceptable compromise and the overall value of carbon credits should be sufficient for the 436 Czech companies involved. Environmentalists have welcomed the lower carbon credit limit. The Spanish telecoms giant Telefónica has bought a majority stake in Český Telecom. Under a contract signed in Prague on Tuesday, Telefónica will pay the Czech government 82.6 billion crowns for its 51.1% shares in the company. The government will use the revenue to finance social and environmental projects, cover the losses of the bailout agency Česká konsolidační agentura and to implement the planned pension reform. The right-wing Civic Democratic Party has backtracked on an earlier demand for a referendum on the EU constitution to be held separately from voting in the next general elections. Party leader Mirek Topolánek told the Daily Hospodářské Noviny that the Civic Democrats were willing to make a concession on the issue and discuss an appropriate date with other parliamentary parties. The Czech Republic has not yet officially decided on how the EU constitution should be ratified. The Social Democrats and the Civic Democratic Party have both tabled their own version of a referendum bill, the former introducing the referendum as an institution as such, the latter proposing a one-off referendum bill linked solely to the EU constitution. Neither party has so far shown itself willing to support the other's proposal. I'm Daniela Lazarová and that's the end of the news.
This is Radio Prague and I'm Kate Barrett. Czech car maker Škoda Auto will begin making its Octavia brand cars in China. We also look at a Prague museum fighting to save one of the oldest merry-go-rounds in Europe. And we find out more about one of the most famous Czech sports organizations, Sokol. Stay tuned. The carmaker Škoda Auto announced this week that it would begin producing its Octavia brand in China, starting with its sedan version in 2007 and later estate cars. Just over 2,300 Octavias were sold in China last year, but Škoda plans to produce some 40,000 vehicles at its Shanghai plant within just a couple of years. A Czech brand for more than a century, Škoda is wholly owned by German manufacturer Volkswagen AG, which already makes cars in China and has made inroads into India. Brian Kennedy recently spoke with the Central European correspondent for Automotive News Europe, Lyle Frank, about the significance of the move.
Škoda announced this week that they're going to be making Octavia's in Shanghai, China, beginning 2007. And this is the first full-scale production of Škoda cars outside of the country. It's interesting because, number one, it's the first production. It also makes Škoda a brand in the world's largest and fastest-growing car market.
The production in China, it will be for purchase in China. That's the idea.
Initially, they said it would be for the Chinese market. China does have the goal of exporting cars, and that's going to be starting, I guess, in 2007, 2008. That is in process. So theoretically, Škodas could travel from China to other places in the globe.
You were saying earlier that the Volkswagen Group, Volkswagen brand, and the owner of Škoda has a 50% market share in China, and not just of imports, of all cars.
Right, because in China you basically have to make there to sell there. And so they have two factories, I believe, and they're making a Santana brand, which is more of a local car, and then a Shanghai Passat, which is very similar to the Škoda Superb. And so the Octavia will be positioned between these two cars. The Chinese people, I guess, prefer three-box sedans, not combis.
It will be an Octavia.
It will be an Octavia. It will be the new Octavia, and it will be branded as a Škoda. So it's not just an Octavia body with the Volkswagen nameplate pasted on the front.
Now, roughly one out of every five people on the planet is Chinese, and another one is Indian, and Škoda is also making inroads into India.
Correct. Škoda is basically the lead brand for the Volkswagen Group within India. However, with India, they are going in as kits, and they're using cars that are essentially manufactured in Mladá Boleslav and reassembling them at the plant in India. In China, they will be making the complete cars.
And how is Škoda being branded? How's it being marketed, rather, in India as against the Volkswagen?
In India, Škoda is marketed as an upscale brand for people that want to be seen. They've had Škoda Superbs and I believe Octavias placed in a few Indian action flicks from Bollywood. So they are definitely aiming at the top end of the market. It's not an economy car. With China, you can make a comparison to Pilsner Urquell, and it's being owned by SAB Miller. And that's taking the brand outside of the country, but not production. With Škoda, they are part of the Volkswagen Group. And with the India move, it's just like exporting beer, but just bottling it in a different site. With China, though, they will be making the complete car in China and basically just taking the name out from the Czech Republic. The indirect influence would be that it increases the visibility of the Škoda brand name throughout the globe and then potentially would increase demand for the vehicles.
That was Lyle Frink, the Central European correspondent for Automotive News Europe. You're tuned to Radio Prague. This week has been an important one for football fans, with the quarterfinals being decided in Europe's prestigious club football tournament, the Champions League. Czechs, too, have had plenty to watch, with several of their own players playing on Champions League teams. For example, Juventus's Pavel Nedved, Liverpool's Milan Baroš, and Chelsea's Petr Cech. Cech, labeled one of the world's best overall goalies, was in action Tuesday.
Ten Kánův odkop reagovat. A ještě je to vítězný gól pro Bayern. Bayern vyhraje ten dnešní zápas.
It wasn't the best of games for Petr Cech, a 3-2 loss on a scrappy last-minute goal. But in the end, it was enough for Chelsea to down Bayern Munich on aggregate, keeping their Champions League dream alive. The team has now made it to the semi-final and will face either England's Liverpool or Italy's Juventus, whichever eliminates the other in their upcoming match. Either semi-final means this year Czechs should see a significant first, the first time one of their own makes it to the final of the Champions League. Shocking as it may seem, no Czech has ever done so.
No, teď je najednou nechytí balón, který by jinak chytil samozřejmě i poslepu.
Midfielder Pavel Nedved came close in 2003, but the final slipped agonizingly beyond his grasp, thanks to a yellow card. He never stepped onto the pitch. Last year, Monaco's Jaroslav Blashill also came close, but spent what must have been an equally painful experience on the substitute's bench. And this year, that seems more than likely to change. Barring another yellow card or injury, a Czech should take to the field in the final match. The sentimental for many must be Pavel Nedved. At 32, the player Juve fans know as Furia Čeka has had a measure of bad luck, repeated injury this season. Recently, Nedved indicated he might even throw in the towel. But when he has played, he has done so brilliantly, and he remains one to watch. This might still be his year. The other sentimental favorite is Chelsea's Petr Čech. Defeated Tuesday night, the world's number two goalkeeper has been something less than his usual tour de force, conceding an uncharacteristic 10 goals in his last 5 Champions League games. On the other hand, there have been brilliant moments too, stopping the ball dead on the goal line and keeping Chelsea in the match. Could this be his year? We'll have to wait to find out, but that said, there would be something appropriate if the first Czech to appear in the vaunted final was actually named Czech. That would be a first no statistician could forget.
Thanks, Jan. And now for a poem. The Prague-born poet Rainer Maria Rilke once wrote of a Paris carousel. And it whirls and whirls and is just to come to rest, revolves in circles and has no final aim. They pass in green, in red, all gaily dressed, a hardly begun little profile here and again. At times they turn their smile towards you, their best and dazzling, and squander it, almost in jest, on this breathless, blind-eyed game. Well, Prague's Technical Museum is in the midst of raising funds to repair a similar antique carousel, which has stood on the edge of Letna Park, right by the museum, since 1894. The carousel is one of the oldest surviving constructions of its type in the world, and quite something to behold, festooned with knights, ribbons, and, of course, many a lavishly decorated horse. Rosie Johnston went along to experience all the fun of the fair.
The Letna Carousel, or merry-go-round, originally stood miles away in another part of town, but shortly after its first birthday was moved to its current location. Newly constructed tram links at the time brought people from all over Prague to Letna in order to have a ride. More than a century later, this extraordinary construction belongs to Prague's Technical Museum, which is battling to save it. Barbara Reznerova is a museum spokesperson.
The carousel or merry-ground was built in 1892, and it was never closed, never repaired, so it works all the time. A man turned the carousel, but it has engine now.
On a visit to Letna, I talked to long-term resident and seasoned carousel rider Maria Šediva about the memories she had of the merry-go-round.
My jsme byli jako děti na kolotoči chvíli, že jo? A byl tam pán.
When we were children, we spent every moment that we could on the merry-go-round. There was a man who always looked after it. All the horses were attached to a big round base. He would hang on to one of the horses and with one foot push the whole thing round. He would do this fast and for a long time, and we used to absolutely love it. And then when I had children, I took them there, and my grandchildren too. It was so beautiful and clean. It was decorated with ribbons and other such frills. It was decked out in the style of its day. And then the communists came and gave it a facelift. They added some cars to the carousel, which were just too kitsch. The kitsch was just horrible.
No, to byl strašlivý kitsch.
The carousel was originally very well made. The materials used in its construction were for the most part of a very high quality, which, as Barbara Reznerova tells me, makes the carousel expensive to repair.
Interesting is that the horses, they have original horse skin on them, but basically they are made from wood. And we have to find specialists who can reconstruct them. One horse costs 250,000 crowns to repair.
The approximate sum that the Technical Museum needs to fix the merry-go-round amounts to around 6 million crowns, which is nearly $260,000. Until this is raised, the carousel is closed to the public, and Honzik, Shemik, Blesk, and the other horses are well and truly confined to graze. But as Letna inhabitant and UNESCO chairwoman Yaroslava Mozerova explains, funding may well be at hand.
I would say it's not only a work of art and, of course, a heritage piece, but it's an institution for the Letna people. I think that if they made a collection among the Letna people, everybody would be happy to contribute. And I have to think about whether we couldn't do something for them through UNESCO.
So here is hoping that sufficient funds can be raised to allow yet another generation of Czech children to play at jockey.
That was Rosie Johnston with that report. You're listening to Radio Prague, where it's now time for Czechs in History. In this Czechs in History, we'll be looking at one of the most famous and enduring Czech organizations ever, the patriotic athletics body known as Sokol, or Falcon, a gymnastics organization founded in Bohemia in 1862 that soon spread to various countries throughout the world, including Slovenia, Poland, the US, and Australia. For our purposes, though, we'll be looking at the Sokol movement in Canada, which is now 94 years old. Jan Wellinger recently spent a month in Toronto meeting Czech Canadians who had at least two things in common: membership in Sokol and a passion for volleyball.
Serve, set, and spike. Members from two impromptu teams urge their fellow teammates on in a heated match at a Sokol gym. This could be anywhere in the Czech Republic. But it isn't. This is West Toronto. The ball is set up yet again, and two players clash at the net. Thirty-five-year-old Peter Kazik never belonged to Sokol in the Czech Republic, but discovered the organization here, in Toronto. The organization helped him meet other Czechs like himself, making a new start.
Yeah, I began on in 1998, when I was here for a 6 months visit. I met nice people, we had a lot of fun, volleyball, a couple beers, so yeah, fun.
He also got to know many Czechs who had been in Canada for generations, but who had never lost their Czech roots.
That helped me very much, because here are not only people which care about money. It's about, the Sokol here is about people, to get together, about community, about language. We can talk in Czech, and it's really nice to be here.
Charlie Heichel, a first-generation Canadian, agrees Sokol is important. He has also taken part in the organization's most characteristic events, the so-called sleds, large gymnastics festivals in which dozens of performers take to the field to perform carefully choreographed exercises that are a spectacle to see.
Sokol for me, it's pretty much been a way of life since I was about 8 years old. I've been gymming on Saturdays and on Wednesdays, and I was actually the director of men for about half a decade here in Toronto. I also met my wife through Sokol. We met in 1994, just before we went to the sled in Prague.
What exactly do you do?
We do calisthenics. We perform calisthenics in Prague. It's the main sled, so there are a good 25, 30 numbers that various age groups and men, women, together, boys, girls, they all perform. You know, it's all about athleticism, and the healthy mind is a healthy body, and vice versa.
And you find that to be true?
I find it to be true. Mind you, I've only been coming here for the last month. I've had about a year hiatus, so I'm a little bit out of shape, but yeah, a healthy mind is a healthy body.
Part of Sokol's mystique abroad is precisely that it has maintained such a steadfast framework for Czech Canadians to keep in touch with their European heritage. One of Sokol Canada's most prominent organizers, Jan Waldauf, explains the very first units were founded by Czech immigrants to Canada way back in 1911, 7 years before the very foundation of Czechoslovakia.
It was in 1911, and as a matter of fact, it was in Western Canada. in a coal mining region on a border between the provinces of Alberta and British Columbia. There's a small village there called Frank. And in 1903, they had a very serious natural disaster where part of the mountain collapsed and practically wiped out the whole village. And, of course, those miners, because it was caused, they thought, by mining activity that the collapse occurred, they refused or did not want to go back to the mines. So then the mining company started to recruit miners in Europe, and among them was a group from that time Bohemia, northern Bohemia, and they came to that town of Frank and settled down there. And, of course, in some of them were former Sokos. They established the first Sokol unit in Canada.
The miners founded two units that cooperated with U.S. counterparts to the south, where the Sokol organization had taken root much earlier, 40 years before. According to Jan Weldauf, several members then volunteered to fight in Europe during the First World War in the Bohemian detachment of the 225th Battalion. Such displays of courage and moral steadfastness were characteristic for an organization that was banned three times in Bohemia, first by the Austrians, then by the Nazis, and finally by the Communist Party. Sokol members in Czechoslovakia, with their dedication to democratic principles, were naturally targeted for persecution. Many ended up in prison under the communists or in Nazi concentration camps. The luckier ones escaped to the West.
Sokol was, from its very inception, based on the idea of democracy. And that, of course, was, first of all, certainly one of the objections that communists had against them. And the other thing would be that Sokol, because of its, I guess, loyalty to the Czechoslovak state, to the Czechoslovak nation, no matter where they were still in support of the values that actually, I guess, denoted the First Republic of Masaryk and Beneš, the physical fitness. That really is just a means to the other values that we have, which is a certain courage, endurance, honor, truthfulness, and these are all values that Sokol tried to foster and was relatively successful in doing so.
In Canada, additional waves of immigration in the 1920s and 30s had led to the establishment of new Sokol units in the east of the country, in Toronto and Montreal, as well as the newly established town of Batawa. These centers only increased in importance after the communist coup in Czechoslovakia in 1948. At that, Sokol membership in Czechoslovakia had swelled to 1 million. But it would be the organization's last stand on home soil, before many members and their families fled to places like Canada, Australia, the U.S. Ivo Siptak, a longtime member of the Toronto unit, recalls his father's own role in Sokol in Czechoslovakia. He says following the protest at Prague Castle in 1948, Sokol's fate at home was sealed.
The Sokol movement went to the castle to protest killing of Jan Masaryk. So they were marked men right there. And the next day, they took over my dad's businesses. He couldn't go to the bank. He couldn't go to his home. My dad was in denial, more or less, and actually his cousins, who had more of an overview of everything, what could happen, convinced him that we should leave Czechoslovakia right away.
Jan Weldauf agrees the protest in 1948 was the last stand. Sokol's activities then would shift to democratic countries, fueled by new émigrés who hoped communism in Czechoslovakia wouldn't last. In the early 50s, Sokol Abroad was symbolically established to counter the dissolution of the organization in Czechoslovakia. For their part, Czech Canadians would keep the tradition alive in Canada, holding their first SLET in Toronto in 1953. By earlier standards, it was only a small gathering of just over 100 gymnasts. Still, the message was clear. The organization was determined to continue in the face of what was happening in Prague. Meanwhile, in the 50s, newer and newer units were established, one of the most curious in Quebec.
It was established in 1955. And it's in Noranda, Quebec. It's a mining town. a mining city, I guess one could almost call it, and Noranda Mines, who are, I guess, oh, at that time certainly had the largest copper mine in the world. They, of course, had a lot of workers up there, and they established for them a recreational center. So I drove up there. It's about a 10-hour drive from Toronto. And we did establish, in fact, a so-called unit there, which was very unusual in that it was really an experiment, I guess, in that we had only one member that was Czech and one member that was Yugoslav. The Czech's name was Kwasnička, and one Yugoslav, Drago Zheryov. And we established a so-called unit up there, which had a fairly substantial membership, now mostly young people, who did their exercising in this recreation center that the mine established.
The rest of the members were mostly French-Canadians. The unit, however, did not last. Sokol is deeply tied to the history of the Czechs and Slovaks, and in its many local variations has, of course, changed over time. Today, the sled festivals are far more modest than the famous displays of countless gymnasts in motion at Prague's enormous Strahov Stadium. The exercises take less time and are set to music that is more modern. But a certain mood of patriotism remains. In the Czech Republic, too, Sokol was revived after the fall of communism, and 2006 will see another sled in Prague. Canadian Sokol members are already looking forward to displaying the country's maple leaf alongside the colors of the Czech flag. They may have found new lives in a new country, but they never forgot their allegiance to Sokol, founded so many years ago.
I guess that's an old tradition, and that probably will stay as long as Sokol will be in existence. The red, white, and blue, or the blue, red, and white, it doesn't matter how you take the combinations, but those colors are always visible and shown and displayed with pride, I would say.
That was Czechs in History, prepared this week by Jan Wellinger. Well, that brings us to the end of today's program. So for now, from me, Kate Barrett, and all of us here at Radio Prague, thanks for listening and goodbye.